watched the cheerleaders practice. I take out my 5-subject notebook. New subject? Ashley Davenport. She's easy to spot in the group of girls in maroon uniforms on the far side of the gym, her red hair against all the blondes. She's tall, too. Not towering, but taller than most of the other girls. Slender. Her voice, when she's shouting out the cheers, is clear and bright.
Let's G! Let's G! Let's O! Let's O! Let's go, mighty Gators! Let's go!
I watch her for a while, take some notes, and in the next 45 minutes of observing her, here's what I learn. Ashley Davenport can kick really high. She can also do the splits, and 3 back handsprings in a row. She's strong. She makes it look effortless when she stands with another girl balancing on her shoulders. That's about all I've got. I shouldn't have sloughed 8th period. I try to remember Ashley from other times I must have seen her at my brother's basketball games, but back then she was just another cheerleader, another set of waving pom-poms and a pack of 2 short polyester skirts. I didn't have any reason to pick her out from the rest. There's a sudden click, the noise of a camera going off, and I suddenly understand the phrase jumping out of your skin with much more clarity. I turn, ready to see the principal or campus security here to bust me for truancy. I have a good excuse, just as soon as I come up with one. Also, can it be truancy if I didn't leave school property? But it's Damien. He's sitting on a bleacher 2 rows above mine, wearing his usual gray hoodie and baggy jeans, holding a camera with a big lens and focusing on the cheerleaders. "Oh, hi, Damien," I say reflexively. I'm not even that surprised to see him once my heart rate goes back to normal. What are you doing?
I take pictures for the yearbook, he explains as the camera clicks again.
He lowers it and turns to look at me.
What are you doing, Lex?
Just hanging out, I say, as if the gym is so relaxing. He nods like this makes perfect sense. I didn't know you were a photographer, I say. He sweeps his shaggy hair out of his eyes with the back of his hand.
I've been dabbling in it, seeing if I can get the camera to speak through me or whatever. I'm invisible to people, you know, which makes it easy to get interesting candids.
That sounds mildly creepy. You're not invisible, I say. I see you. He smiles the timid smile again.
I know, but with some people... Most people, really, I just fade into the background. If I disappeared one day, really disappeared and never came back, they wouldn't even notice.
I'm just the opposite, I think. I feel like I've disappeared already, the Lex that I was before, and some people have definitely noticed I'm gone. But them noticing I'm missing doesn't mean I get to come back. I must look tragic and contemplative because Damien tries to lighten the mood.
That's high school for you, though, he says. Everybody's caught up in their own thing. We're all the stars of our own movies. Anyway, that's my big superpower, Mr. Invisibility.
Right. I rub my shoe against the metal ridges on the back of the bleachers. Damien takes another picture of the cheerleaders as they line up for another cheer.
We've got pride, clap, clap, clap. On our side, clap, clap, clap. You know it, we show it. We've got pride!
Who comes up with these things? I say. Seriously? He nods.
Hey, they are excellent rhymers. Pride and side, know and show. Like, whoa.
We both laugh. Nothing gives nerds more innate satisfaction than poking fun at cheerleaders. Did you ever cover the basketball games? I ask. For the yearbook, I mean. He nods again.
Sure, a few.
Did you see Ty play? My voice catches on my brother's name, because I don't say it that much anymore, not out loud, in public. And saying it makes me feel vulnerable or slightly selfish, like I'm asking for sympathy or attention. I didn't mean to bring Ty up, but I can't seem to help myself. Because Damien knew Ty, he really knew him, probably better than any of Ty's jock friends ever did.
He never missed a shot,
Damien murmurs. Then his eyes widen over how that sounds, in my own personal context.
He was good. They haven't won a single game since he...
And there is the pause. This time I don't fill it in. I let the silence drag.
I might have a few pictures of him from this year, if you want them,
Damien says after a minute. Yeah, I want them, I answer. He coughs into his sleeve.
I would have given them to you earlier, but I didn't know if you'd...
I want them, I say again. Please.
Okay.
He's uncomfortable now. I've made him uncomfortable. I shouldn't have brought up Ty. I check my watch. Anyway, I say, the bell's about to ring. We should... I stuff my notebook in my backpack and start to climb down out of the bleachers. Damien follows me. He helps me get over the metal bar at the bottom of the seating area. Thanks, Damien, I say.
See you later, Lex,
he says, and then he slouches off. The bell rings. I take one more look at the cheerleaders as they head for the locker room. Ashley Davenport lags behind. She stops and kneels to tie her shoe. The others drift away. Who is this girl, I wonder? What happened between my brother and her? What happened? She finishes tying her shoe and stands up, but she doesn't follow the others. She looks across the basketball court, past the bleachers, at me. I'm torn between the urge to duck and the urge to wave, but I don't do either. I simply stand there, staring at her as she stares back at me. For a minute, we're suspended in time. I have the letter with me. I always have it with me. I could give it to her. I could go right now, down the bleachers, and I could put it in her hand.
Hey, Ash, some girl calls, peeking out of the locker room. Are you coming? We're going over to Starbucks, remember?
She lowers her head quickly.
Yeah, I'm coming.
She doesn't look at me again as she walks to the locker room door. 12. On the bus ride home, Sadie slides into the seat next to me. I don't think I've ever seen her ride the bus before, but here she is, in ratty black jeans and green Converse sneakers, her shoulder brushing mine as the bus bumps along the street.
Do you want to have dinner at my house?
She asks. My mouth waters just thinking about dinner at the McIntyre house. Sadie's mom is a culinary genius. Pot roasts and lasagnas and fried chicken with mashed potatoes, all the various meals I've eaten at the McIntyre home cycle through my mind, bite after wonderful bite. I get out my phone to text my mom and tell her that I'm going to be home late. Out with a friend, I type. She should be happy with that. See Lexi socialize. But when we get to Sadie's place, the house is strangely quiet. I remember it always being a bustle of activity and noise before. Sadie's brothers talking and joking and jostling, music blaring, her mom screaming for them to keep it down. But now there's nobody home by the sound of it. Sadie leads me down the stairs to the family room in the basement. It looks the same as I remember, same couch, same paint colors, except the TV is bigger now. It still smells faintly of popcorn, from when Sadie's parents bought an old popcorn maker from a theater in Lincoln when it went out of business. But the machine is gone, a patch of slightly lighter carpet outlining where it stood against the wall. We used to love to watch it heat and pop, the burst kernels spilling out like a delicious volcano of buttery goodness. We spent hours down here, hours upon hours, a decent percentage of my life.
Have a seat, Sadie says, and plops herself down on the couch.
Where is everyone? I ask. She frowns like she doesn't understand the question. Your brothers?
Oh, they all have their own places now, except Seth. Josh is married. Austin's in law school. Matt's studying child psychology at UNL, though he changes majors every few months. They're around, though. They come for Sunday dinners and show up if they need to do laundry.
She puts her feet on the trunk that serves as a coffee table and sighs contentedly.
It's nice having the TV to myself.
Everything changes, I think. That's the only constant. We all grow up. Almost all of us. I remember watching Jaws here, I say, sliding down on the cushions next to her. What were we, 8? My mom would have killed me if she'd known. Sadie shudders.
It took me years to get over that movie. I couldn't even swim at the lake without imagining a shark in the water under me, waiting to rise up and bite me in half.
She turns the TV on and brings up the DVR, where I see, predictably, a bunch of episodes of Long Island Medium. But there's also Ghost Hunters and Paranormal State and My Haunting and pretty much every other ghost-related show on television, which for some reason I didn't expect. I wouldn't have pegged Sadie as someone who would obsess over the occult.
"Do you have a preference?" she asks. "We don't have to watch ghost stuff. We can watch anything. We can just veg if you want."
"Why do you like those shows?" I ask. "Because I don't get it. I don't understand how any rational person who isn't wrestling with the idea of her dead brother possibly being a ghost watches those shows." Sadie shrugs.
"I'm morbid, I guess. I like the idea that we don't stop after we die."
"You believe in heaven and all that?" Her eyes meet mine, startled.
"Well, yeah, I do."
"But if heaven exists, what's this ghost thing about?" I gesture at the TV. "So everyone Teresa hears on her show is a person who didn't go to heaven, who's just sticking around Earth hoping to chat with whatever medium comes along?"
"No,"
Sadie informs me matter-of-factly, like this is scientifically proven.
"Teresa deals with spirits, not ghosts."
"There's a difference."
"Spirits are people who've passed on to the other side. It's like another dimension, and they can visit us and watch over us and pass along messages, but they're at peace. Ghosts, on the other hand..."
It occurs to her then that I might not want to hear this, and she falters.
"What about ghosts?" I ask, sitting up.
"Tell me."
"Ghosts haven't crossed over. They have unfinished business in this world, so they linger."
I want to laugh it off and say it's all a bunch of crap, but I can't. Not after everything.
"So you think what I've been experiencing is a ghost," I surmise. "Not a spirit." "Well, you saw his figure, but he didn't speak," Sadie explains, "which is more consistent with ghosts. Spirits are talkative. And he's a suicide."
"But why does that matter?" I find myself asking, my voice sharper than I mean it to be. "I mean, with suicide, they want to leave this earth. They want to cross over, right?" She bites her lip, and I wonder if she's not telling me that she believes suicides go to hell, or being a ghost is a kind of purgatory. A punishment. I wonder if she's judging him like everyone else.
"I think with suicides, a lot of times they're hanging on to something," she answers finally. "Some anger, or some pain, or something they've got to work out."
"So you think my brother is trapped in my house because he has something he has to work out?" I say. "Unfinished business." "It's a ridiculous notion. Stupid. Crazy. Dumb." Sadie doesn't answer. I take the letter out of my backpack and sit for a minute holding it. "Ty's unfinished business."
"I don't know that he meant to give this to her," I say flatly. "What unfinished business could he possibly have with Ashley? I mean, they broke up. He's dead. That's finished business, I'd say." "You haven't read it, have you?" Sadie asks in her raspy voice. "I've wanted to. I have so wanted to." "It's sealed. He wouldn't have sealed it if he wanted anybody else to read it."
She stares at the envelope thoughtfully.
"Well, you have more self-control than I do. I don't know if I could not read it if I had a letter like that."
"It's sealed," I say again, as if that settles it.
"You should read it. Then you'll know what Ty wants you to do with it."
"Sadie," I say, shaking my head, "it's not real. Ty's not a ghost. He doesn't want anything. He's dead." Her eyes flash up to my face.
"You don't think he's real?"
"But what about..." "I saw him for maybe a total of 5 seconds. I don't even know what I actually saw. The first time, I might have fallen asleep watching television and dreamed it, and the second time..." I think about the way Ty's face loomed up at me in his bedroom mirror. "I don't know. I don't know what I saw. Maybe it's me that's the problem. Maybe I'm..." She folds her arms across her chest.
"Crazy? You think you're crazy?"
I smooth down a corner of the letter. My nails are short, jagged, bitten. I don't even remember biting them. It's a bad habit I've never had before. That all by itself is like proof that there's something wrong with me. Sadie shakes her head.
You're not crazy.
I glance up.
How do you know? Because crazy people would never wonder if they're crazy. Come on, Lex. If you're insane, then the rest of us are in big trouble, is all I'm saying.
I don't find this very reassuring.
Even if you are crazy, which you're not, and even if the ghost isn't real, she points out, the letter's still real, and it's definitely intended for Ashley. So you should give it to her.
I should give it to her, she says. This girl who broke my brother's heart. This cheerleader. I shake my head.
No, I murmur. Don't you think you should respect his wishes?
Sadie asks. My shoulders are instantly tight. My lungs start to close up. It feels like it's all coming down on me at once. Bad dreams, bad memories, bad choices. It's too much.
What wishes did Ty respect? I throw back at Sadie. Why doesn't anyone ever ask that, I wonder? Where's the respect there?
Lex, hey, it's okay, Sadie begins. I know. You don't know. I cut her off.
I didn't ask for this. I'm not Ty's messenger boy. If he wanted this girl to have the letter, he could have mailed it. He could have left it where someone else would find it, not me. Why does it have to be me?
Maybe he wanted you to read...
No! I don't believe in this stuff. I won't. I don't want...
I can't finish the sentence. The hole ratchets itself wide open in my chest. I'm out of air.
You don't want him to be in your house, Sadie murmurs.
It's the most horrible irony. Ty hating his life so much that he chose to end it, only to wind up right back in our house, back in his room, stuck, as helpless to change his situation as ever. It's the worst thing I can think of. I won't believe it. I sit for a minute, not breathing. Sadie lays her hand on my shoulder and squeezes. She doesn't say anything but pulls me into a hug, and I let her. When we were younger, she smelled like cheap laundry detergent and ivory soap and kid sweat from all her running. Now the aroma coming off her is a fruity perfume, some kind of melon mixed with a whiff of cigarettes. After I regain the ability to take air into my lungs, Sadie pulls back.
Do you need to punch something? She asks. I find that punching something is therapeutic.
I shake my head, embarrassed, wheezing. Nobody has had such a front row seat for the hole in my chest before.
I'm sorry. I've been kind of a spaz lately.
She flaps a hand at me, like whatever.
Don't be sorry. It is what it is. When my dad died, I thought I was going mental for a long time. I had all this pain, and I didn't know what to do with it, so I just puked it out on other people. My mom and Seth got the worst of it.
I stare at her. Her dad died. I knew that, somewhere in the back recesses of my brain. It happened 3 years ago, the summer we were 15. Her dad had been playing catch with her brothers in the backyard, and then he just sat down on the grass and said he was out of breath. And then he died. I was at math camp in Vermont that summer. My mom called to tell me. I didn't go to the funeral. Sadie and I, we'd grown apart by then.
God, I think. What kind of selfish, horrible friend am I? I forgot her dad died. That's why her mom's not home. Her mom had to get a job. That's why the house is so empty.
It's okay, Sadie murmurs. It is not okay. It is not okay. I don't know what to say. I suck. Right then, the door behind us opens, and Seth wanders out. He's wearing camo pajama bottoms and nothing else, his short blonde hair tousled. He rubs his face and gives us a sleepy grin.
Hey, what's going on?
His gaze moves over to me.
Hey, Lexi.
Hey, Seth.
He's different than I remember, too. He's taller, obviously, filled out from the lanky teen he used to be, with muscles and tattoos splashed across both biceps, a black dragon stretching down his ribs. He raises a pierced eyebrow at me.
Long time no see, he says.
I nod.
Are you just getting up?
Sadie snorts.
He sleeps all day. Slacker. I am not a slacker,
Seth argues, unfolding his half-naked frame unceremoniously on the couch next to me. Where Sadie has just a hint of nicotine on her, Seth has a cloud of stale cigarette smell floating over him.
I work nights. He's a desk clerk at the Residence Inn off the Cornhusker Highway,
Sadie informs me, like this is the most slacker job ever.
He basically sits on a stool all night and brings people extra towels.
The side of Seth's mouth quirks up. He turns his attention to the television.
Don't tell me you're watching the ghost stuff again. That stuff's bullshit, you know. Do they ever get a real ghost on tape? No. They get strange orbs, weird floating lights, mysterious creepy sounds. No real evidence of a ghost. It's a fucking scam.
I'm inclined to agree. Plus, I'm jealous at the way the swear words can simply flow off his tongue, like it's no effort to produce them.
Hey, Lex, I think I found something for you to punch, Sadie replies fondly.
I could tell you a ghost story better than anything you'd see on TV,
Seth boasts. Sadie scoffs.
Okay, smart guy. Go ahead. Tell us a ghost story.
Are you sure you want to hear it?
Oh, we're sure.
He looks at me. I nod.
Okay.
He leans forward, elbows on his knees, and puts on a serious expression.
A few years ago, I worked at Circuit City on O Street.
I almost laugh. Somehow, when I heard the words ghost story, my mind didn't jump straight to Circuit City on O Street.
It's closed down now, but I worked there for like a year. It was a pretty normal job. A slacker job.
He smirks at Sadie.
Mostly I hung out in the DVD section and tried to keep the punks from shoplifting movies. They always stole weird stuff, too, like The Notebook and Mary Poppins and shit.
Ooh, terrifying, Sadie mocks. He ignores her.
So one night after we'd closed up, I went into the back office to get some receipt paper to restock my register, and I got this weird feeling.
A weird feeling? Sadie's skeptical. Like maybe the feeling that you should get a real job?
He looks at me again. His eyes are the same cool blue I remember.
A feeling like there was someone watching me. At first, I thought maybe someone was in the room with me, like a customer or a burglar or somebody. I said, "Who's there?" And I picked up the baseball bat that my boss kept in the corner of the office. I went into the back room, and I turned on the lights and checked all the corners and stuff, but there was nobody. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling.
I wait for Sadie to make another snarky comment, but she doesn't. She's leaning forward, waiting to hear the end of the story. So am I.
So I put the bat away and turned to go back out on the floor, and that's when I noticed it.
He leans back, clearly enjoying the fact that we're so interested.
The shadow.
I can't help it. A chill goes down my spine. I shiver.
Shadow?
Sadie repeats hoarsely.
On the wall, there was a shadow of a man. And then I, like, whipped around to see what was casting the shadow, and I saw this dude standing there, just looking at me. He was an Indian. He was wearing the buckskins and moccasins and the feather in his hair and the whole Native American ensemble, which was weird enough, but what was weirder was that I could sort of see through him to that sign on the wall that counted how many days since the last accident.
It's quiet for several seconds. Sadie and I are holding our breaths.
So, go on, Sadie prompts. What did you do?
I took a couple quick steps back,
Seth says. And what did he do? I want to know.
He nodded, all solemn, and then he lifted his hand up like this.
Seth raises his palm.
And then he said, "How?"
How? I repeat. How what?
Like, "How, white man, I come in peace." And after that, we were totally friends, me and Tonto, and every night after work, we'd knock back a beer.
He starts laughing. Sadie smacks him on the shoulder.
"You doofus," she cries. "God, can't you be serious for 2 seconds?
He keeps laughing. I sink back into the cushions, part relieved, part disappointed, while Sadie chews him out. Doofus, she called him. I swallow.
But seriously, though,
he says, catching Sadie's wrist when she tries to pummel him.
That Circuit City was built on an old Indian burial ground. Look it up on the internet if you don't believe me. And sometimes, for real, we'd hear footsteps or things would be moved in different places when we left the room. Seriously.
Come on, Lex, Sadie says, disgusted, jumping up. Let's get away from this loser.
Love you too, baby sis,
he calls after us, grinning wickedly.
You should have seen your faces. Priceless.
She takes my hand and tows me toward the stairs. When we get to the kitchen, she gets out two paper plates, unwraps two frozen burritos out of the freezer, microwaves them for 2 minutes, and then scoops one up with a spatula and sets it in front of me. Plop.
Ladies and gentlemen, she says, dinner is served.
Mom's still up when I come in a few hours later.
How's Jill?
She's sitting at the kitchen counter flipping through a Better Homes and Gardens magazine and sipping a glass of white wine.
Did you have a nice time?
She asks. Actually, I was hanging out with Sadie McIntyre, I confess. A mix of surprise and disapproval crosses her face. Sadie's not what she would think of as a good influence, but she covers it up quickly.
What brought that about?
She asks, keeping her voice light.
I didn't think you and Sadie had much in common anymore.
We have more in common lately. Comprehension dawns in her eyes. Mom has no trouble remembering that Sadie's dad died. Mom's a decent human being.
Well, I think that's nice, you and Sadie, she says after a moment. You two used to be like peas in a pod.
I nod, remembering Sadie's face when she talked about her dad, the tension in her mouth like she was trying to keep her lip from quivering, even after all this time. She believes that her father is in a better place now, but that doesn't stop her from obsessing about ghosts and spirits and what happens after we die. I think about what she said about the letter for Ashley, that it doesn't matter if the ghost is real or not, that Ty intended for Ashley to have it, that I should respect his wishes.
You look lost in thought, Mom says, startling me.
Long day?
The longest, I say,
which is what every day feels like.
Do you want to talk about it?
She asks.
That's nice.
I wish I could tell Mom about the letter situation. I can imagine telling her, the way I used to occasionally ask for her advice, and then she'd help me work out the insignificant problems I had in my life before. But my mother isn't that Mom anymore, and I'm not that Lex. The woman in front of me now, pouring herself a second, or however many, glass of wine, is almost a stranger to me. But I do know one thing about her. She's fragile. She's barely hanging on. If I told her now about me seeing Ty, she'd lose her grip. She'd fall.
Rain check, okay? I tell her, giving her a brief hug. I'm wiped.
In the hallway, I notice that the empty frame, the one with the missing picture of Dad and Ty, is on the floor again. I pick it up. The glass in one corner is cracked. I turn it over and inspect it, but there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the loop on the back or the hook on the wall. It just happens to be on the floor. Again. I sigh. Just once I'd like to get through a day with nothing weird happening. I go back to the kitchen. Hey, Mom, I ask. Did you do something with this picture? She frowns.
What picture?
I hand her the frame. It's the one with Ty and Dad going hunting. Did you take it out? She shakes her head, staring at the empty space in the frame.
I remember that day, she murmurs. Your father was so proud.
And Tyler. She doesn't finish her sentence, but she doesn't have to. I know. Ty never wanted to kill anything, not a fish or a deer or a spider even. That's just how he was. How is it, then, that he managed to do such damage to himself? Mom wipes at her eyes.
No, I didn't take it.
And now I've started my mother crying again. Perfect.
There's another picture missing, though, she adds, from the stairwell.
What?
Your father's graduation picture. I noticed it the other day when I...
When she went down to sleep in Ty's bed. I go straight to the stairs. There are dozens of pictures on the wall here as you descend into the basement, all the awkwardly posed family photos and pictures of both sides of relatives. A picture of Dad and his two older sisters standing in front of their house with 70s hair when Dad was just a toddler. A portrait of Graham and Pop, Mom's parents, at their wedding on the steps of a stone church. Dad with a dorky little beard, holding a wet and naked baby, okay, that's me, in a fluffy orange towel. Grandpa at a 60th birthday party. Christmas card photos of my cousins. Terrible class photos. And Mom's right. There is a picture missing on the bottom right side of the wall. The frame's still there, but the photo is gone. It was a black-and-white professional photo of Dad wearing a suit and tie, smiling serenely like there was nothing in the world he'd wanted so much as to graduate with a B.S. in accounting from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Sigh. Just one freaking day. When I was a kid, I had a thing for Sherlock Holmes, the way he was able to ascertain so much by using deductive reasoning and simple observation. I went through a phase where I told people that I was going to be a detective when I grew up. But now I've got this seemingly simple mystery in front of me, and I have no idea how to go about solving it. I head back up the stairs. Mom's still sitting at the kitchen counter, still drinking, still crying. She glances up, sniffles. "Yes," I affirm. "The photo's missing."
"I thought your dad might have stopped by and taken it," she says. "He still has a key to the house. Maybe he took the one in the hallway, too."
That explanation makes sense, I guess. Both missing photos are of Dad. But, A, I hope Dad doesn't feel like he can sneak into the house whenever he likes and take stuff. He could ask me if he wanted something. I wouldn't give him any grief about it. And B, why would he take the photos but not the frames? Why would he take the time, mid-sneak, to carefully unfasten the frames, slip the photos out, and then return the frames to their proper places? And finally, and maybe most importantly, C, why would he take the photo of himself at graduation, and the hunting photo, and not take, say, the picture of his sisters, or of Grandpa, or of the one where he's holding me? "We should change the locks," I say to Mom. She sets her glass down on the counter.
"Because we have a photo thief on our hands?"
"Because Dad shouldn't have the key to the house anymore. Or I can ask him to give it back, I guess. Whichever you prefer." She folds her hands in her lap and looks down at them, her decision-making pose.
"I don't know, Lex. That seems excessive."
"It's not excessive. It's been 3 years since he moved out. They're divorced." "Dad's never coming back," I want to say to her, but I don't. I don't want to push her. But I wish that Mom was stronger, that she didn't cry, that she hadn't been so devastated when Dad left, that she'd done that woman-scorned thing and piled up his stuff in the yard and burned it all. Maybe, I think, if she hadn't been so weak, then Ty could have let go of the rage he felt whenever he saw her hurting like that. He could have moved on. And then maybe he would never have made that first attempt with the Advil, and maybe it would have occurred to him to fight back when life got tough. Maybe he'd still be alive. So in that moment, even though she's kind of the only thing I have left in this world, I blame her. But there's nothing to do with that emotion but swallow it down. "I'll ask him," I say to her, although I don't clarify whether I'm referring to the photo or the house key. I turn away. "I'm going to bed." I tilt my head toward the hall and my waiting bedroom. "I'm thrashed."
"Night," she says. "Sleep well, sweetie."
"Yeah, right." 17th of February. The last basketball game I saw of Ty's was in the first week of December. December 3rd, if I remember correctly. A Tuesday night. On Thursday morning, Mom would get called into the principal's office because Ty had punched one of his jock friends. Broke his nose, so the story went. By Friday, people at school were giving Ty that "we're so over you" look. So Tuesday night might have been when he and Ashley broke up. That was the week Ty made shooting guard on the junior varsity team. It was a big deal. He was proud of it. I could tell by the half-jog he did as he came out onto the court that night, wearing the black jersey with the number 2 on his back. He tried to look confident through his nervousness, nonchalant, unruffled, oh so cool. Then he gazed up into the stands the way he always did, scanning the crowd. He never said so, but I knew he was searching for Dad's face. Dad was the reason Ty started basketball. Basketball had been one of Dad's obsessions back when Ty was around 12. Dad was like that before, always looking for a new weekend hobby, finding something that interested him and then getting consumed by it, spending all his time and extra cash on procuring the best equipment and how-to manuals and clothes. I used to chalk it up to Dad having the most boring job in the world, so he was looking to get some excitement in his life. Every few months, it was a different thing. Tennis is the first one I remember, a string of early Saturday and Sunday mornings where Dad went off wearing white shorts and carrying a racket. Then sailing. Dad bought a sailboat. Yes, a sailboat in Nebraska. Landlocked state. And a different set of white shorts, and spent two entire summers gliding back and forth across Branched Oak Lake before he lost interest in that. Then came inline skating, which was mercifully short, only a few weeks that he dragged us out to the empty church parking lot, laden with pads and helmets to practice pivoting and stopping. Then mountain biking, which ended in Dad breaking his leg. Then chess, while the broken leg healed. And then, if I remember correctly, it was basketball. We woke up on a Saturday morning to the sound of a ball hitting the concrete in our driveway, Dad wearing some kind of jumpsuit, throwing and missing and cursing as the ball bounced off the hoop he'd just installed over the garage door.
"Hey, kiddos," he said when we went out on the porch to watch him. "Want to shoot some hoops?"
I declined. I'd borrowed a book about Einstein from the library, and I wanted to spend the day curled up in my room, trying to get my 14-year-old brain around the theory of general relativity. But my brother's eyes lit up. Finally, something he could do, something he and Dad could do together. After that, Ty was always out there practicing. Dad moved on to hunting and guns and target practice that year, but Ty stayed with basketball. The team was up against Omaha North that night, in the last game I saw Ty play. Math club was running concessions, per usual, but they let me sit out in the stands for most of the game, and then rush back at halftime to help fill sodas and pour nasty molten nacho cheese over stale chips and run the register. So I saw him play. I caught the look he sent into the crowd, the search for Dad, and when he glanced in my direction, I held up my hand and smiled. He nodded, glad to see me and disappointed that I was alone, and turned away. He didn't look up into the bleachers again. Dad came to a few games in the beginning, but that petered out fast. I guess he couldn't bear to be away from Megan for that long. It's a shame, though, that Dad didn't get to see Ty play. It was a thing of beauty to watch him. And it would have made Ty so happy, even though he never would have admitted it, if Dad could have seen just how stellar he'd become on the court. He was the best shot on the team, no question. Sometimes I wonder if that's how the math gene presented itself in Ty, his ability to calculate angle and force with the muscles of his arm, so he could hurl a ball from half a court away and then stand back to watch it swish effortlessly through the net. He wasn't the fastest player or the tallest, and he wasn't great at blocking or guarding or slam dunks, but my brother could shoot. I want to remember that game. I've tried so many times in the past week since I figured out that the letter belongs to Ashley Davenport. I try to bring up even one shot he made that night. He must have made several. We won the game 97-33. I remember the freaking score. The red digital numbers lit up on the board. I remember what happened right before as he came out with the team, and what happened after, but no matter how many times I go back through it, I don't remember any specific moment with Ty during the actual game. When I try to think about it, instead I remember 17 days later. Sorry, Mom, but I was below empty. And then everything goes mercifully numb. Or I get the hole in my chest. One or the other. Here's what I do remember about December 3rd. Stephen came down from the concession stand about 10 minutes in, said Elle and Beaker had it covered. He took my hand, and he held it for a while, and then he turned it over and ran his index finger up and down the length of my palm. All my nerves started firing. I shivered and laughed and told him to quit, but I liked it. He laced his fingers with mine, and we watched the game. But I was really watching Stephen, the jerk of his Adam's apple when he swallowed, the small freckle he had next to his right ear, the way he pushed his glasses up on his nose a bit awkwardly with his left hand because his right hand was holding mine, the way his eyelashes were long enough to brush the lens if he pushed the glasses too close to his face. I remember that at the beginning of halftime, Beaker did an imitation of Principal Boone that was so funny that Elle snorted soda up her nose, and we were trying not to die laughing almost the entire 15 minutes of the break as we counted out the people's change and served their food, and they were looking at us strangely because what could possibly be so hilarious, which made us laugh even harder. I remember Mom showed up 20 minutes before the game was over. She looked tired but happy that she'd made it. She smelled like the hospital when she sat down next to me, like Clorox and burned plastic and antiseptic. She said hello to Stephen, and he produced a Hershey bar with almonds, Mom's favorite, from his jacket pocket, and said he'd snagged one from the booth just for her. Oh, the smile she gave him, the approving mother smile, like a ray of sunshine in that cold gym. Stephen knew how to bask in it. "You're a total kiss-up," I told him, bumping my shoulder into his. "Where's my candy bar?" He shrugged, but his eyes said that there were things in this world better than candy. Yes, there were. I remember we stayed parked outside the house for longer than usual when he brought me home, until Mom flipped the porch light on and off, which was her way of saying, "Enough necking, time to come in. Good night, Stephen." "Mom, please, you don't have to do that," I told her when I slipped inside the house. "I'm perfectly capable of deciding when I should call it a night." My lips were swollen, and my hair a total mess, and my face felt flushed, probably red because I was embarrassed that I looked like I'd been making out, which I had been, excessively. And my mother was standing just inside the door like the chastity police. "Are we going to have to revisit the talk?" she asked. "God, no. Once was enough for this lifetime, thanks." "Okay. Do you want me to take you in and get a prescription for birth control pills?" My mouth opened and then closed. I frowned. "No. Well, maybe. I don't know." "Condoms break," she informed me. Now I knew for a fact that my face was fire engine red. "I am aware of that. Good grief, Mom. Where's Ty?" I asked, sure he was going to jump out from the hallway with a giant smirk. I did not want to be having this conversation in front of him. "Ty's not home yet," Mom said. "Ah, maybe he needs the talk." I started past her toward the safety of the hall and my bedroom, a full-scale retreat, and for once I was glad that Dad didn't still live with us. One parent in this situation was bad enough. I didn't need Dad and his shotgun. "I just want you to be safe," Mom called after me. "I'm safe," I answered, and then I went in my room and closed the door and took a deep breath. Because I was safe. Stephen and I hadn't been past, what were the bases again? Second base yet. But we were definitely on second, taking a few steps in the direction of third. Maybe it was time for us to discuss it, I thought. Maybe it was time. I wanted it to be Stephen, the first time. I knew that much. I didn't know when or how or where something like that could happen, but I did know who. And sitting there in my bedroom thinking about it, I blushed and I smiled. December 3rd. I remember all that in detail. Stephen, Elle and Beaker, Mom, Stephen. But I don't remember Ty playing. I don't remember him interacting with any of the cheerleaders. I wasn't paying attention. I was too busy being the star of my own movie, while my brother might have been out there that night, in the dark somewhere, getting his heart broken. And 17 days later, he was dead. 13.
"So, how's the writing coming?"
Dave asks from his comfortable chair. "Swell," I reply. He waits for me to give him a straight answer. I shrug. I don't think it's doing me much good. I glance at the clock.
God,
42 minutes to go.
Why do you say that?
He asks. There's no real point to it, no purpose.
We discussed this. The purpose is to release some of the pain, express it onto the paper so you don't have to carry it around with you in your day-to-day life. It's cathartic.
Yeah, that's not happening, I report. I'm still carrying around plenty. His eyebrows bunch together. Dave has very expressive eyebrows.
Are you writing about Tyler?
Look, I did what you asked. I wrote about the firsts and the lasts. I sigh. I think it's time to try something else. Let's just call it done with the writing part of the healing process, okay? He rubs his hand over his mouth, then says,
But how does it feel when you're writing?
Honestly? It sucks to try to remember. It hurts. I don't want to do it anymore.
Ah, it hurts. Good, he says.
Wait, I think. Good that it hurts? But then it hits me. Dave knows about the numbness. Somehow, he knows. And this writing thing isn't his attempt to get me to express my feelings, so much as it's trying to get me to actually have feelings. Dave's sneaky that way. Maybe I want to forget, I say, just to be contrary. Maybe it'd be easier to forget and get on with my life. Isn't that healthier, moving on?
Is that what you really want?
Dave asks. Would you please stop answering my question with a question?
What would you like me to say? Aren't there some vital questions that you must answer for yourself?
Dave doesn't play fair. I sit back and consult the clock again. Ugh, 38 minutes.
I think you should continue with the journal. Humor me for a while longer,
he says.
What I think you might need to make the writing seem more relevant is a recipient.
A recipient? That doesn't sound good.
Someone you are writing to.
Oh, this just keeps getting better and better. He sees the look on my face.
Alexis, I'm not suggesting that you give the journal to anyone. It's for your eyes only, I understand. But perhaps if you use the journal to express something to someone specific, you'll be able to get some of the weightier issues off your chest.
I arch an eyebrow at him. You're saying I need an imaginary audience, so to speak. Do you have someone specific in mind?
Well, let's see,
Dave says, as if he hasn't already given this a lot of thought.
Maybe you could write to a future version of yourself. Many people write their journals to future selves, I think. It demonstrates a kind of hopefulness.
So my audience would be some wise Alexis who's made it through all this crap and occasionally cracks open this journal to see how far she's come and says to herself, Whew, I'm glad that's not my life anymore.
Exactly.
I wish I could be her, I think, fast forward through this part of my life. I shake my head. But maybe she's just as messed up as I am. Maybe all of this has twisted me irrevocably, and I will forever be incapable of a healthy, normal future. Maybe it would only torture future me, having this record of where it all went south.
Is that what you think?
Dave asks.
That you're twisted?
He takes a few seconds to write something in the yellow legal pad he keeps his notes on. This makes me nervous. Time for a change of subject. Or I could write to aliens or robots or whoever's left in 10,000 years. An extraterrestrial will lift this book in its gray fingers and think, so this was the life of a female Homo sapiens. How interesting.
Yes,
Dave says, like he is taking me completely seriously.
You could write to aliens.
Who am I kidding? Nobody's going to care. Not future me, and certainly not an alien species. This is pointless.
You could write to God. That has been known to be therapeutic to many people,
he suggests. No, I don't have anything to say to him. I mean, I don't believe in God. Dave writes more in his notebook.
You could try writing to someone else, he says then. Someone you want to talk to. You could speak to him or her by writing, even if that person never reads it.
even if that person can't hear.
That's when I understand where he's been leading me all this time. That person. You mean Ty?
If you'd like.
I don't want to write to Ty, I say without hesitation. I had my chance to talk to him, when it counted, when it would have meant something, and I missed it. He's gone.
The people we love are never truly gone.
Yeah, you know what? You should design bumper stickers or something. That's profound. That's catchy. He sits back.
You seem tense today, Alexis. Has something happened?
My heart rate picks up. A part of me still wants to tell him everything, ask him what I should do about the letter, and talk about the times I've seen and smelled Ty, the dreams I'm having about him, just get it all out there in the open, see what he'll have to say. But my desire to confess is still considerably less than my fear that he will think I'm crazy, and if a mental health professional thinks I'm crazy, I probably am.
Lex,
Dave prompts.
What are you thinking about?
Nothing. I say automatically. Nothing's happened. 31 minutes. He sighs and writes something else in his notebook.
Well, I think your assignment this week should be to figure out some kind of audience for your writing.
A recipient, I say.
Yes.
Great, I answer. It's fruitless to argue with Dave. He's so freaking calm. I'll get right on that. I can't wait. 14. This time, Ty and I are swimming in Branched Oak Lake, the water cool and green and deep under us. At first it feels just like the old days. He says he'll race me to the shore and we start out swimming steadily side by side. Then I become aware that I am swimming alone. I've lost sight of Ty. I tread water and look for him. He's gone. Nothing but dark water all around me. I call his name. I turn in the water, searching, and then suddenly he comes up right beside me, spraying me, laughing.
Gotcha, he says. Look at your face. What, did you think I drowned?
Jerk, I say as my heart rate begins to slow. There was another dream I had a couple of nights ago, in which he drowned in a swimming pool, a lifeless shape at the hazy blue bottom that I was trying to fish out using the pool net.
You know you love me, he says now.
I do.
Hey, what's that?
He looks off over my shoulder at something in the water. I think he's still joking around with me, but I turn. There's a fin cutting its way toward us, maybe 20 feet away, then 10, then 5. Then it glides under us, out of sight.
Uh-oh, Ty says gravely. I knew we shouldn't have come out here. It's not safe.
Don't worry, I say, with that weird logic that exists inside dreams. This is fresh water. As if my stating this fact will negate the existence of this inevitable shark. He pivots in the water.
There, he says, pointing down. Do you see it?
I see it, a huge dark form taking shape below us, closing in. It's on us before I can catch my breath. Ty screams. He thrashes and goes under. There's billowing blood in the water. Ty pops up again, sputtering, caught in the middle by a massive great white. I try to grab him as the shark shakes him the way our dog used to shake her toys. Ty! I cry. Tyler! Ty! I can't get a grip on him. He's too slippery. Then, as suddenly as it came, the shark is gone. Ty comes to the surface, gasping. His face is white as milk, his lips tinged with red.
Lex,
he chokes. I turn him over onto his back, grab him by the shoulders, and start to tow him toward shore. Blood trails behind us as I swim. So much blood, too much, but I don't stop to think about that.
Lexi,
Ty says again, this time like a warning.
No,
I kick hard. Swim with as much power as I can, but the shore doesn't seem to be getting any closer.
I have to go,
he says. I stop.
No, stay with me, Ty.
It hurts,
he whispers.
Stay with me,
I plead.
Stay!
His eyes close, his breath rattles in his chest, and then stops.
Ty!
I scream, and then I sit up with a jolt, tangled in sheets. Another dream. My hands are shaking. My breath jerks in and out of my lungs. I can still feel the cold of the water. I can still smell the blood. A bad one this time. Really bad. There's a soft tap on my door, so soft I wonder if I really heard it. I try to make my breathing quiet so I can listen, which is hard. Another tap, louder, real.
Honey?
It's my mother's voice behind the door.
Are you all right?
I fumble for my glasses, pausing before I put them on to wipe my wet face. Was I crying? I couldn't have been crying. I don't remember. I straighten out the blankets before I answer.
I'm fine, Mom.
The door opens. She pokes her head in.
I heard a noise. It sounded like you were upset.
I wonder if she heard me yell Ty's name.
I had a nightmare is all, I say. I'm okay.
She comes in and sits at the edge of my mattress. When I was little and had nightmares, sometimes she would crawl into bed with me and stay there for the rest of the night, her body so warm and soft and safe that the nightmares never came back. And then, after Dad left, for the rest of that lousy summer, I slept with her because she couldn't bear to sleep in their big bed all alone without him. She snored, loudly, like a wounded pig. But then again, the time she stayed with me when I was little, in the twin bed so small she had to sleep sideways to fit, I used to wet the bed. The things you do for the people you love. She tucks a strand of my hair behind my ear.
Sometimes I dream about your brother, too.
She meets my eyes. There's a painful knowledge there. She heard me call his name.
Yeah,
I whisper. I can't explain it to her, how they make me feel, these dreams where Ty dies. They're bad, and it feels like they're getting worse, more graphic in nature. But I don't want to stop having them. In some morbid way, I like having them, because at least then I get to see Ty. I get to talk to him sometimes. At least when I'm there, when Ty is dying in whatever way he's dying, I'm with him. I'm hanging on to him. I'm asking him not to go. In those moments, I can do something for him that I didn't do in real life. I can answer the text. I can be there.
Valium helps. Do you want a Valium?
Mom asks.
I don't dream when I take them.
What is it with people trying to force-feed me drugs? I shake my head.
It wasn't that bad.
She hesitates.
I'm fine, really,
I insist.
All right, honey.
She leans to kiss me on the temple.
I love you.
It wasn't fair for me to be blaming her before. Not for Ty. All she's ever been guilty of is loving too much.
I love you too, I say.
She gets up and goes out, closing the door quietly behind her, as if there is someone else in this house she doesn't want to wake up. I lie back. 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. But sleep doesn't come for a long time, and when it does, the dreams are all still waiting. 21st of February. The last time I saw Ty...
Strike that.
22nd of February. Dear Dave, this writing thing is killing me. Can I please stop now? I've been hanging out with a new friend, by the way. Well, an old friend, technically, but a new friend. Healthy, right? Cathartic, right? I'm the picture of sound mental health, I swear.
Strike that.
23rd of February. Dear alien race in the future, please don't read this journal as a representative of the typical life of a human adolescent. It will screw up your research for years to come. In fact, it's probably best if you simply disregard what's written here entirely. Also, if you haven't already, please don't annihilate the human race. We can be charming. Yours truly, Alexis P. Riggs. 15. My car won't start. I'm in the parking lot at Dave's office after yet another scintillating hour of non-productive conversation, and now, to top it off, the lemon is screwing with me. It does that sometimes, some kind of...